If you want to keep your brain working at its best well into old age, all the standard advice about exercise and social relationships and continuing to learn new things still applies. But here's another one you may never have considered. If you're at high risk of developing dementia, maybe the best thing you can do for your brain is to take care of your hearing. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. A recently published study compared two groups of older adults with hearing loss. Some took part in health education sessions to learn about preventing chronic disease. Another group got hearing intervention in the form of hearing aids. The results don't suggest a magic bullet, but they did yield some fascinating insights. Dr. Frank R. Lin is director of the Cochlear Center for Hearing and Public Health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and professor of otolaryngology. The study on hearing intervention and cognitive decline was published in The Lancet. Frank, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Before we talk about the specific study that was just published, I'd like to explore the hypothesis that hearing loss might be linked to cognitive decline in the first place. What is the evidence linking those two conditions?
Yeah, so this research, Chris, is relatively, new from the arc of research perspective. Namely, this has really been coming up just in the last 15 years, actually. And right now, we understand there might be three major mechanisms through which hearing loss could actually affect cognitive decline, even your risk of dementia. And to start with explaining these, the first thing to understand is when I'm talking about hearing loss, what it really means, it's not you can't hear, but what everyone develops hearing loss over time is because the cells in the inner ear begin wearing out. So the cells in the inner ear, those are the cells that take in sound, those vibrations in the air, and convert them with very, very good accuracy and fidelity into a signal that then goes to the brain, and the brain has to decode the signal. So with hearing loss, which everyone experiences as we age, it's basically because the cells in the inner ear, they can't regenerate over time. So over a lifetime of noise exposure and aging, we lose some of those cells. And what happens then is the ear can no longer send sounds as clearly to the brain. So a lot of times you'll say, it's not that you can't hear somebody, it's that you can't understand them. It sounds like they're mumbling it. But that's what hearing loss is. So with that understanding in place of how hearing loss works, the three major mechanisms linking hearing loss and cognitive decline dementia, the first one is this notion of idea of cognitive load. And what that basically means is that when you can't hear well, the brain's constantly receiving a garbled sound, and because of the brain's constantly having to work harder to process that sound, namely the brain's using up sort of brain energy or brain resources to dealing with hearing when those brain resource or brain power could have been used to help preserve our thinking and memory abilities. So it's not so much that hearing loss causes dementia there, but hearing loss can lead to earlier unmasking of dementia because you don't have those brain resources that otherwise would have been available. So that's the first idea, this idea of cognitive load. The second idea, it's going to sound similar, but it's actually really, really different. And it's the idea that hearing loss in and of itself does, in fact, detrimentally impact the brain's structural integrity. And what I mean by that is this general notion, use it or lose it. Namely, if parts of the brain aren't being stimulated by sound, high quality sound from the ear, that those parts of the brain begin to atrophy faster. And that literally is what you see if you follow, you do animal studies or follow humans over many, many years with serial MRI scans. That's exactly what you see, is that parts of the brain begin atrophying faster if they're not being stimulated by sound. And importantly, those parts of the brain also are important for other areas of learning and memory too, because you know it's not that the brain does, one part of the brain does one thing, a lot of times it subserves other areas of brain's function as well. So that's the second idea, this idea that hearing loss may directly affect the brain's structural integrity. And finally, the third idea is going to be the most common sense for a lot of people, but the idea that hearing loss actually, for some people, you may not be as socially integrated, you may not be as socially engaged, you may not go out as much, or if you do go out, you may not engage in the conversations as much. And that idea of social isolation or loneliness or basically just sort of loss of cognitively stimulating activities, we know is incredibly important for maintaining your cognitive function over time. The important thing to note here though, Chris, though, it's not that one of these pathways is right, other ones are wrong. We're understanding now it's likely a combination of all three pathways through which hearing or hearing loss can detrimentally impact our cognitive function over time.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, age-related hearing loss can be about a combination of problems with our ears and problems with our brains. Is that problems with auditory processing specifically?
Well, it's a little different. So when we talk about hearing, hearing really occurs in two steps. And I mentioned before, the first step is really the inner ear, the cochlea, taking in sound, converting that sound with really good accuracy into a signal. And then the signal goes to the brain. And the second step is a brain that has to decode that signal into meaning. So when we talk about auditory processing, what that really means is sort of the second step. So the first step is auditory encoding, right? The second step is auditory processing or decoding. So we sort of, that's why people say we sort of hear with our ears, we listen with our brains per se. When we're talking about hearing loss in this context though, we're not talking about a brain auditory processing issue. What we're really talking about is just literally wear and tear on the inner ear over time that leads to a sort of a much more garbled signal going to the brain. So the brain's constantly having to work harder to process that much more degraded signal.
Why might cognitive decline be a factor for those who lose hearing acuity later in life when, as I understand it, it does not really pose a particular risk to folks who've been deaf or hard of hearing their entire lives?
Oh, great question, Chris. So it all comes down to the mechanisms, right? So let's take an extreme. So all this research, by the way, I'm talking about nowadays, summarizing this last 10, 15 years of research, is all based on older adults, people in their 60s, 70s, 80s, who have essentially had normal hearing their whole lives, essentially, but have lost it, progressively, all of us do in our 50s and 60s and things like that. So they've been hearing for their whole lives. What we're talking about, when we talk about the other extreme, let's say people who have, who are born deaf, right? Who, a child who's born deaf, and about 1 in 1,000 kids are born deaf, and some of them go on to just learn to use American Sign Language and, visual forms of communication. You can imagine then the mechanisms are completely different. Namely, when you have, let's say it's extreme, you learn sign language as a child, there's no cognitive load then of processing auditory stimuli if you're primarily based on using visual forms of communication. Likewise, that's the idea of cognitive load that's going to be completely different in a child. The second idea of how hearing loss can affect the brain's structural integrity, how hearing loss affects a developing brain early in life is very, very different than how hearing loss will affect a person's brain later in life that's very, very attuned to hearing. Namely, at a younger age, your brain's far more plastic, obviously, and what I mean by neuroplastic, the brain's far more malleable and adaptable early in life than later life. So that's very different effects, hearing loss in early life versus later life. And the last path, which you mentioned before, the idea of social isolation and loneliness, you can imagine for someone growing up in a deaf community using sign language, they're never really socially isolated, right? So the mechanisms are very, very different in, let's say, a young child, as opposed to the vast majority of hearing loss, far and away, is the people who develop hearing loss in later life, people who just gradually lose hearing beginning in our 50s and 60s over the course of our lifetime.
So we know that gradual loss of hearing in older age can happen to people who've been exposed to loud sound for many years in, say, industrial work environments. But this can also happen for people even without a lifetime of noise exposure?
Yeah. So literally it's... we like to say in a way that, hearing is very, or here let's say hearing loss or gradual loss of hearing is very much a normal part of aging in the sense that just like getting wrinkles and white hair is very much considered a process of aging that happens. It's the same thing with hearing loss. And the reason for that, again, is that your inner ear doesn't regenerate. Just something about the mammalian inner ear, the cells can't regenerate. So you can imagine over a lifetime of just, well, from a lot of factors. Well, noise exposure is a big one, but also just general aging and mitochondrial dysfunction. Certain drugs can just contribute a little bit and damage the ear over time too. There's a lot of different processes can affect just subtly over time those cells in the inner ear, which then over a lifetime basically means all of us lose those cells progressively over the course of our lifetime, no matter what we do. Clearly, though, obviously, if you have a lot of noise exposure like that, that can increase your risk and you'll have more hearing loss per se.
Since this comes on gradually, I'm curious as to whether most people who've experienced significant hearing loss are actually aware of the problem, or is it only their life partners who are aware of this problem?
Chris, that's always a running joke, though, and you're absolutely right. It's a lot of times because it comes on so gradually, a person's brain, in a good way and a bad way, and you'll see where I'm going with this, begins to adapt for it, right? Your brain sort of it fills in some of the blanks. You get better at sort of guessing at what people say. You use some of the more visual cues. So because it comes on so gradually, a lot of times you don't notice, right? People don't notice, except everyone around you notices, right? So it's always the running joke is always it's not what the person knows, but they're certainly their loved one, their spouse, they recognize recognize it, right? And it's very easy, if you're not aware of what hearing is per se, to blow it off. It's to say, oh, it's my wife. She mumbles at me all the time. These kids nowadays, they mumble at me all the time, right? But that's what hearing loss is. It's hearing loss fundamentally how it's experienced by almost everyone is that things just don't sound clear as they used to. The people sound like they're mumbling at you. And if it comes on so gradually, it's very easy to just sort of blame it on other things, blame it on other factors, when without realizing that, in fact, it's just like all of us, it's just some gradual diminishment in hearing over time that's intrinsic to sort of everyone as we get older.
How bad does hearing loss have to be before interventions like hearing aids are recommended to folks?
So the best way of thinking about that is, you know, there's general terms of quote unquote mild or moderate hearing loss, which are really just, they're terrible terms actually. We use them medically, but we only because we have to. A much better way of thinking about hearing, which we're trying to advocate going forward, is for people that are, you know, much like people might know their blood pressure, their weight, or their heart rate, so know your hearing number. And the hearing number is just basically, it's something from an audiometric perspective called the pure tone average. And what it represents is just how loud speech sounds have to be for you to hear them. And you can imagine if you hear very, very soft sounds at a level of 0 decibels, your hearing's great. Versus the louder the number gets, you know, that number can range from 0 to about 70 or 80. The higher the number is, the poorer your hearing is. And we typically use cutoffs of when your hearing is between 0 and 20, you can hear sounds as soft as 20 decibels. That's considered normal hearing. Between 20 and roughly 20 to 35 is considered a mild hearing loss. 35 to 50 is considered a moderate hearing loss, and so on and so forth. So that the hearing number is really important for people to understand and to be able to track their hearing over time. We typically say, though, with those numbers in place now, is that we typically see in these large epidemiological studies that there's roughly this proportion increase in risk of cognitive decline dementia once you start crossing over about 20 decibels. So as your hearing number gets greater, your increased your risk of dementia and cognitive decline at a population level appears to increase as well. Just as a case in point, when we did the ACHIEVE trial, which you mentioned before, the ACHIEVE trial specifically recruited people, older adults, who had a hearing number, but basically between roughly 30 to 70 decibels, which is, you know, roughly corresponding to a mild to a moderately severe level of hearing loss.
So it doesn't really need to be exceptionally bad before it can contribute to cognitive problems.
No, it's actually, it's the term mild hearing loss, I hate to say it because it's mild implies, oh, it's not that bad, right? You don't need to do anything about it. But I'll tell you, if someone had quote unquote, it's a really good hearing, all of a sudden one day you woke with quote unquote a mild hearing loss, that hearing loss, you would really notice it. And the reason I know this is because, you know, the other hat I wear is I'm actually an ENT surgeon. So I'll see people who have had a sudden hearing loss related to an uncommon viral infection that affects the inner ear. And they'll come to my office and say, you know, Frank, Dr. Lin, I can't hear anything. I can't participate anymore because it came on so acutely. When it comes on very slowly, though, over time, which happens to most people, your brain sort of gets used to it, though. It's not that it's not significant anymore. It's just the brain's gotten so used to the brain's better filling in the gaps. But that hearing loss that came on acutely, I guarantee you people would notice it because it's so detrimental to how you can hear and communicate. The trick is just because it comes on gradually over the course of decades, people can accommodate to it. But that accommodation, though, you think it's a good thing. The brain gets used to it. It's probably not, though, because by getting used to it in many ways, it comes at a cost. Namely, the brain is having to work much harder to compensate for it, or you're already beginning to restrict some of your activities that you're not putting yourself out there in situations where you need to sort of hear as much, in other words.
Frank, this is called the ACHIEVE trial. What did you want to look at in the ACHIEVE trial?
So the ACHIEVE trial really asks, in the end, a really simple question. Namely, if we treat hearing loss in older adults, people between 70 and 84, who have, you know, just a mild to moderate hearing loss, this is the bread and butter hearing loss that affects, you know, 50% of people in that age range, does that, in fact, reduce risk for cognitive decline, right? And this is among, you know, healthy 70, 84-year-olds who aren't showing any signs of dementia and they have hearing loss, if we actually treat it, namely just treat it using hearing aids and strategies to help people use their hearing aids, does that in fact reduce cognitive decline? The reason we're asking this question again is because over the last decade, all this, you know, epidemiological research just following people in the community for many, many years, we've seen consistently in those studies that hearing loss appears to be associated with a greater risk of cognitive decline, loss of thinking memory ability, as well as a risk of increased dementia. But just seeing that observation, hearing loss and sort of poor cognitive outcomes, It doesn't necessarily mean that if we treat hearing loss, that that reduces the risk, right? Namely, when we treat hearing loss, you're not making the hearing loss go away, right? It's not a curative therapy. It's just a rehabilitative therapy. So that's all the question. That's all the trial wanted to do, is ask that very simple question.
What criteria were used to choose participants?
So in the end, we recruited from four different sites across the United States. There was a community site in Minneapolis, another one in Hagerstown, Maryland, which is a rural part of Western Maryland, around the Wake Forest area in North Carolina. So that's Forsyth County, North Carolina, and then also Jackson, Mississippi. So sort of four different regions around the United States, sort of spread across geographically as well as urban and rural. In that study, in the CHIEVE study, we recruited basically 70 to 84-year-olds. These are healthy, you know, people living in the community, either alone or with a spouse, who had, you know, roughly, again, I said a hearing number between 30 and 70, which corresponds roughly between a mild to moderately severe level of hearing loss, and otherwise who had no cognitive complaints at baseline. So we recruited from those four different regions. Importantly, we recruited from two different study populations. And what I mean by that is that we recruited about a quarter of the sample from an existing group as a heart health study called the ERIC study, the Atherosclerosis Risk and Community Studies. These were about literally 16,000 people who have been followed for 30 years who were recruited from a RAM sample many, many years ago just to track their cardiovascular health over time. But we recruited about 250 people from that sample. And then the other 750, actually roughly about 730 people, I believe, we recruited from people, new healthy community volunteers, people who responded to advertisements about a trial we're doing around healthy aging and cognition, hearing, but people responded to new ads. So in the end, we recruited from two different groups of people, again, the people from the existing heart health study, as well as these new healthy community volunteers.
So what sort of interventions were offered to each group?
Yeah, so the real study intervention was a hearing intervention. And what that basically means is that if people got randomized by flip of a coin, they got assigned to the hearing intervention. That basically meant they met with a study audiologist for about four different sessions over space of about every 2 or 3 weeks for the first about 3 months of the study. And then in those sessions, the audiologist assessed their hearing, assessed sort of their hearing and their communication needs or lifestyle needs. Based on that they then got fitted for hearing aids. Sometimes they also got fitted for other sort of related hearing technologies. Like for example, if you're in a busy restaurant all the time, you might get fitted for a remote microphone you can put on the table so you can hear people at the table, even across from you or down the table. But you know, different technology strategies like that. So that was a hearing intervention. So basically just one-on-one sessions with audiologists getting hearing aids, any related technology to help support you in terms of, you know, your general hearing communication needs. The other group got randomized to essentially a control intervention. And what I mean by that is they got assigned to a health education intervention control. And what that basically means is that they had one-on-one sessions with a certified health educator to go over topics that have been shown to be critical for promoting healthy aging, things like prevention of chronic disease, immunization, diet, exercise. And there's actually a program that's put together by the Centers for Disease Control many years ago for how you convey topics that are critical for healthy aging to older adults. The key thing about those two interventions is that they were matched in terms of the amount of exposure to study personnel, the amount of number of visits people had, the amount of time they spent with one of the study staff. And the reason why we did that, of course, is because you can imagine if we had a control intervention, which is basically nothing, just saying you got hearing intervention or you get sort of nothing, we'll see you 3 years later. You can imagine just by a person, you know, coming in, seeing an audiologist routinely, that could be good for your cognitive health, maybe just by having more stimulation. So we really wanted to control for that by ensuring that both groups of people had the same amount of exposure to study personnel.
So the study lasted 3 years. I guess you tested cognitive function in the beginning and then again at the end?
Yeah, basically, we actually tested it. People came in after it took about 2 years to recruit everybody. And then from there, everybody was then followed for 3 years. During those 3 years, everyone was followed. They basically came every 6 months. So every 6 month visits, where at the annual visits, it was a slightly longer visit, we do a whole sort of a complete neurocognitive battery. Well, that's a fancy word saying for basically about 45 hour long battery, different thinking and memory tests, testing things like memory, attention, how well you can produce language and things like that. But sort of what we call a comprehensive neurocognitive battery, sort of assessing all aspects of your thinking and memory abilities over about an hour with a trained examiner. And importantly, what I should note here too is that that thinking and memory battery of tests, most of these tests, 8 of the 10 tests, in fact, didn't have any auditory component at all. So a lot of times people will say, well, people just did better because now they can hear the examiner, they could hear the word being spoken. But the vast majority of these cognitive tests don't even have an auditory component. So if someone's doing better or more poorly, for instance, either way, it's obvious they can't hear the examiner. Again, these are usually nonverbal or non-auditory tests to begin with.
So this is really interesting. Initially, it didn't seem like hearing interventions had all that much of an effect on delaying cognitive decline. What changed when you sorted participants who had significant risk factors for dementia?
Oh, yeah. So this is a great question, Chris. And this is sort of, you know, honestly, it makes complete sense with 2020 hindsight, a lot of things do. But at the first, when we first looked at the results, we're actually disappointed. And it's exactly what you're getting at. When we looked at the whole group together, all, you know, 977 people, of which, again, I said about a quarter came from the heart health study group. The other three quarters came from a healthy, new healthy community volunteer group. When we looked after 3 years, we saw that people who got randomized to the hearing intervention versus those who got randomized to the education control group, that over 3 years, the rates of cognitive change were about the same. There was no benefit of hearing intervention slowing down cognitive decline. They basically both had the same amount of decline over 3 years. But in another of the, what we call the pre-planned analyses we had always intended to do was also replicate the analyses, realizing that the two different study populations may be very different, namely the people who came from the heart health study who have been already were followed for, you know, over 30 years, they truly represent a random sample of the population, they may behave very differently than people who are these new healthy community volunteers, people who respond to Facebook ads, who respond to advertising in newspapers about a new healthy agency and join the study sort of new. And that's exactly what we found, is when we analyzed the groups separately, we saw among the healthy age, the heart health study group, those among those 238 people, that hearing intervention was associated with nearly a 50%, like 50%, you know, halving of the reduction of cognitive decline over 3 years. And that was, I mean, that was a huge effect. I mean, literally cutting in half your rate of cognitive change over 3 years. In contrast, if you look at the other group, the new healthy volunteer group, hearing intervention really had no effect in them. But, and this is the big but, Chris, is that that healthy volunteer group, though, if you look among people who got the control intervention, that control group didn't really even have any cognitive decline over 3 years. So what this goes to show is among the healthy volunteer group, if they had no cognitive change over 3 years to begin with, a hearing intervention can't really slow down something that's not really changing. In contrast, in the heart health group, these are people who are, you know, like I mentioned, they're a random sample many years ago. They represented more of really just a general population. They had a much steeper, they almost had a threefold faster rate of cognitive decline over 3 years compared to the new healthy volunteer group. And so in other words, for that group that had a really strong effect of hearing intervention slowing down cognitive decline, they were the group that actually was at risk of cognitive decline, who actually had cognitive decline, and hence where their hearing intervention was able to slow something down. In contrast, in the healthy volunteer group, which had really no cognitive decline over 3 years, there was no effective hearing intervention, mainly because there was no effect to be observed since they weren't even having any cognitive change.
So what made this initial smaller group of volunteers that had been followed for decades, what put them at higher risk of cognitive decline? How were they different from that new healthy study population that you gathered around the time the study was starting?
So it's not one thing, Chris. There are a lot of factors. So on average, the heart health study group, they're slightly older by about 3 years. So on average, they're about 79 years old versus a mean of 76. So they're slightly older. They also had slightly more risk factors for cognitive decline dementia, things like diabetes, high blood pressure, lower income, lower education. All of those things are associated with a greater risk of cognitive decline over time. The key thing here, though, is what all those little factors likely represent is that the healthy volunteer group, people who newly joined a study, there's something that's long been known in a lot of epidemiological public health studies. It's called the healthy volunteer effect. And that people who newly join a study, right, you can imagine there's 70, 84-year-old adults who newly joined a study, who responded to a Facebook ad, who responded to advertising paper, they usually represent the cream of the crop, right? So these are people who are already really healthy to begin with. That's why they joined another healthy aging study. And those people, because of a healthy volunteer effect, they didn't really have any cognitive decline over 3 years, because those are the healthiest of the healthy people to begin with. That's why they're the ones who had the sort of the wherewithal, the interest of joining a study like this. In contrast, the group that came from the Eric Heart Health Study, it's not that they weren't healthy, but these are people who didn't newly join the study. They already been followed for 30 years. They're a random sample picked many, many years ago who have just already been followed. They represent, by all means, probably more just a general population. People who, you know, didn't purposely reach out to join a study, but they were already in a study. So they decided, yeah, sure, I'll join this other trial because I'm already being followed anyway. Why not, right? So it's not so much they were at greater risk, which they actually, I shouldn't say that, they were. It's probably more that the healthy volunteer, the new healthy volunteer group, they were the really, really healthy sub-cohort, right? These are people who, again, had the wherewithal to join and had the interest in joining a new healthy aging study. And hence, over 3 years, you just didn't really see any cognitive change in these folks because they're healthy to begin with.
You mentioned earlier that hearing loss can affect our social relationships, maybe cause us to withdraw a little more, not engage quite so much. It's worth asking why that has an effect or is believed to have an effect on our cognitive function over time.
So there are a lot of reasons there, Chris, and I think people would say it's probably not fully understood, but there are a lot of really compelling ideas why. So one is that there's a general idea of social integration and participating, you know, actively in social activities. It's stimulating cognitively, right? It means you're going out more, you're having more conversations, you're doing more things. And there's a general notion, without a doubt, that cognitively stimulating activities, whether it's a crossword puzzle, whether it's having a conversation, whether it's seeing a movie or going to theater, those are good for your brain to keep your brain active, right? So there's that aspect of why social isolation could affect our ability to essentially stay engaged with cognitive stimulating activities. At the same time, there are also some more, I would say some deeper, really interesting biological reasons for why we think loneliness may be bad for our health. And this goes to the work of a researcher who passed away several years ago, unfortunately, called John Cacioppo, who really pioneered the thought that people who are lonely are at increased risk of being in a quote-unquote a pro-inflammatory state. Basically, the brain and the body is always making sort of more pro-inflammatory sort of cellular chemicals that make our body more at risk of inflammation, at increased risk of inflammation. And that in turn is, inflammation is a lot of times a final common pathway for a lot of aging processes. People don't know exactly why that is. There's some various theories for why if you're lonely, you may be in increased inflammatory state. Some people have even gone so far as to say it might be an evolutionary response, namely back in the days when we're, you know, essentially 100,000 years ago, if you were socially isolated, being in a pro-inflammatory state may have been evolutionary an advantage because you're better at fighting off bacterial infections, for instance. But no one really knows. But we consistently do see that people who are socially isolated, who are lonely, for instance, if you look at their you look at blood markers, inflammation, they have increased inflammation compared to people who are more socially integrated. And then there's also a general notion that if you're socially isolated, you may be less adherent to medical therapy, to sort of medical advice and good health practices too. So there are a lot of reasons there which aren't fully understood, but more importantly, I shouldn't say not only fully understood, there's probably a lot of reasons why social isolation and loneliness can be detrimental to health over time.
Dr. Frank R. Lin is director of the Cochlear Center for Hearing and Public Health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and professor of otolaryngology. The study on hearing intervention and cognitive decline was published in The Lancet. Frank, I so appreciate you making time to share your expertise on this. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, and you can get the podcast for free wherever you like to get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think, or just go to our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.